Bobby, welcome back to Course in History of Political Thought. One announcement I want to make to everybody, Danny Sanchez just mentioned this to me, is during the week of July 22nd through 29th, which is not this coming week, but the week after that, I'm going to be in Auburn at the Mises Institute because we're having Mises University. Now, I was prepared until Danny mentions, I would thought, well, I'd just be giving my lecture from over there, but it would be a bit difficult because I have four lectures I've got to give that week for Mises U. So Danny, with typical intelligence, suggested, why don't we postpone the shift that lecture to the next week. So next week there'll be a lecture for the course, lecture 5, but lecture 6 won't be the week after that. It'll be the week after Mises U. So we had a holiday last week and we'll be getting another holiday the week of Mises U. So we get a lot of holidays in this course. Now, one thing I hope you'll excuse me if I sound a bit more incoherent than usual. As some of you may know, I see George in the chat has already referred to it. On July 4th, I did a review of a book by Stefan Molyneux, whom I wasn't previously familiar with. I didn't like the book much, and this inaugurated an enormous amount of criticism on a number of different blogs. Apparently, he has a great following. A lot of people like him, and it's gotten me a bit frazzled, so I hope you'll excuse me. I must say I really didn't have any idea how many idiots there are in the libertarian, among libertarian bloggers. It's quite incredible. Not that I'd ever make an unfavorable comment about anybody, but it has to, even when I see some of the comments, I don't believe them. But now, what we're going to do today is a bit different from when we're talking about John Locke. He's quite a bit different from the thinkers we've been discussing so far in the course. So far we've discussed Plato, Aristotle, and Hobbes. And while when I was discussing Aristotle, I mentioned an interpretation that I thought had a great deal to it, that by Fred Miller and Roderick Long, that Aristotle really had a notion of individual rights. I think I find that persuasive. But even if you accept that, you can't call Aristotle a libertarian or anything close to a libertarian, and Fred Miller and Roderick certainly don't do that. And clearly, Plato and Hobbes aren't libertarian, quite the contrary. So far, if we're looking at political thought from a libertarian perspective, we haven't found all that much that we can agree with. Maybe we could find plausible certain things in Aristotle. We can certainly learn a great deal from Plato and Hobbes, but they're not in any way libertarian. Now, the thinker we're going to talk about today, John Locke, is different from those three because he does very much prefigure libertarian thought. In one way of taking Locke's thought, he's very close, if not identical, to being a minimal state libertarian. Now, Locke lived from 1632 to 1704, so he's a 17th century figure. And he was from a pretty well-off background. He attended Westminster School, which was considered the best school of its time. It's somewhat, say, would be a, it's still in existence. It's somewhat like a high school today, but you would learn more, much more there than you would in the average high school. And then he went to Oxford University. And at that time, what you studied in Oxford was basically the classical languages, and you also studied philosophy. But the kind of philosophy you studied was really medieval philosophy or scholasticism. So you studied classical languages and medieval style philosophy. And the language of instruction at Oxford in that time was Latin. So Locke could speak, not only read Latin, but he could speak Latin. And he was fluent in it. That was, sometimes he wrote in Latin. That was his language. And he went to Christ Church College in Oxford. It isn't a single university, say you're going to Harvard or UCLA, where I went. There's just a single university that you go to, but Oxford is an association of different colleges. They're all independent. They have some things in common, but if you attend Oxford, you have to be associated with a particular college, and those colleges have or independent, their faculty are usually called fellows, and they operate independently. However, when students are going for their degrees, there's a final examination that everybody takes in all the colleges. So there's a common final examination, but you go to the college separately. So Locke attended Christ Church College, which was still around, and it was at that time considered one of the most prestigious of the colleges. It was probably the top Oxford college. And after he graduated, he was picked as a fellow of the college, and Christ Church called the fellow students. So a student, when I say he was a student of Christ Church, I don't mean he just studied until 1684, he wasn't one of these perpetual graduate students. I mean, he was on the governing body of the college, and he was a faculty member of the college. And now, you remember one thing, as Locke was going to maturity, remember what was happening in England at the time. There was a civil war going on between the king, Charles I, and the people who opposed him, the Puritans, who eventually Charles I was overthrown and he was beheaded in 1649. And while Locke was attending Oxford, the governing body of the college was under a man named John Wilkins, who was associated with Oliver Cromwell. So Locke grew up during this period of civil war. Then, in 1660, Charles II, who was the son of Charles I, was restored to power. The Stuart dynasty came back. Of course, he wasn't very happy about the previous period when his family had been out of power, and he tried to get rid of people who had been sympathetic to the Oliver Cromwell. So, for reasons I'll be getting into a little bit later, he didn't like, he was aware of Locke and he didn't like him. He thought, and he was right about this, that Locke was opposed to the Stuart rule. He really thought that the Stuarts were, Locke wasn't against monarchy, but he thought that the Stuarts, kings, were exercising too much power, and he was in the party that was against the king. So the king had him removed as a student of Christ Church in 1684. Now, one thing also I think very interesting about Locke, you know, we think of Locke as a philosopher, is what he's best known for, somebody who wrote on theory of knowledge, metaphysics, and what we're talking about today, political philosophy. But he was also trained as a doctor. I should have said as a doctor. He was trained as a doctor. I don't think he took his final license, but he said it was too costly to go to all the dinners you required to take your license. But he was trained as a doctor. And in fact, his main patron, he was attached to an aristocratic family of the Earl of Shaftesbury. Earl of Shaftesbury's name, Anthony Ashley Cooper. So Locke, who a lot of his career was kind of a retainer of the Earl of Shaftesbury. So at one time during the Earl's, when he was serving there, the Earl required an operation, and Locke supervised the operation. So Locke was not only a philosopher, but a medical doctor. Does anybody know what other great philosopher besides Locke was a medical doctor? Does anybody want to take a guess? Somebody said Hippocrates. Well, I was thinking more in the modern period. Ron Paul is certainly a medical doctor. I mean, one of the people who's in the standard canon of philosophy. It was the American pragmatist William James, who was an MD, and he was he taught, in addition to philosophy and psychology, he taught anatomy at Harvard. Okay, so now what I want to go into is Locke's views. I remember he had grown up under in the Civil War, and then he started writing in around stuff on political thought or to political thought around 1660. You remember 1660. Charles II, the Stuart king, would come back. He'd been restored to power. So he would be very suspicious of Locke because Locke was associated with the Earl of Shaftesbury, was opposed to the king, and Locke was suspected of being sympathetic to the Puritans, the people who had opposed Charles I and were associated with Cromwell. And why they think Locke was, they were right about that. Well, because Locke, remember, was friends with John Wilkins, who was the master of Christ Church College, who had been put in by Cromwell. And so Locke was very suspicious. Now, Locke wrote in 1660, I should put also 1662, there were two tracts on government that he wrote, 1660 and 1662. Now, one thing unusual, or might unexpected about these two tracts on government is, remember I said at the beginning of the talk, well, Locke is unlike the other philosophers we talked about, so far he's basically going to defend a kind of a limited state libertarian government. But in these two tracts on government, the ones written in 1660 and 1662, he doesn't take that view. He takes an absolutist or Hobbesian position. Remember Hobbes, in our lecture on Hobbes, remember Hobbes said, well, the big thing we have to do is we want to preserve peace, we want to preserve order, because if we don't have order, then people will always be suspicious of each other. There'll be a war of all against all. So we need to have a sovereign. Everybody will surrender his power to the sovereign, because the sovereign can prevent all these harmful ideologies, especially religious ideologies, from inflaming people into civil war. So in the tracts on government, Locke defends the Hobbesian view, and he says, which is very much in contrast to his later work, he says, well, the sovereign doesn't have to tolerate people's religious views. He can prescribe what the religion is that people should follow. And why can he do this? Well, because he wants to be able to preserve order. He doesn't just want, just the way Hobbes had argued, that the religious ideologies are very dangerous. Different religions can have people at odds with each other. So we don't have to tolerate religion. Now, there's a school of thought called the Straussian thought. Leo Strauss, I've mentioned him before, was a German political theorist who lived from 1899 to 1973, and he taught, after he was Jewish, so he had to go into exile when Hitler came to power, and he taught, he was briefly in England, and then he taught in the U.S., and it's very influential. So he was I don't agree with him, but he was extremely smart person, very great scholar, and he and his students have interpretations that tend to be very different from those of other people. So the Straussians, I'll just tell you, by the way, and the story about Leo Strauss. When I was working in the early 1970s on my PhD dissertation at UCLA, was on Jean Bourdain, who was a French political thinker. I sent a letter to Strauss asking him some questions about Bourdain, and he sent my letter back very minute handwriting, wrote, owing to illness, I'm unable to help you. And then he died a very short time after that, so I guess he was telling the truth. So the Straussian view of Locke is, Locke really didn't change from this Hobbesian position. He was always a Hobbesian. So the people who say that he was, such as I'll be saying, that he was pretty close to a minimal state libertarian, are wrong. He was just concealing his real Hobbesian meaning, that he really remained a Hobbesian. We'll be seeing a little later on, we're discussing some of Locke's views, why they think that. I don't find that convincing, but I just want to mention that is one of the views. Okay, now, when Charles II came back in 1660, the Earl of Shaftesbury, remember him, he's Locke's patron. Locke was serving him, and he actually supervised an operation, medical operation, saved Shaftesbury's life. He was opposed to King Charles, and the main reason for that is, remember, during it was a religious conflict. Charles II was, of course, he was a member of the Church of England, the Anglican Church. Remember, who's the head? Can anybody tell me who is the head of the Anglican Church? This is according to Act of Parliament. Who is the king? Doctor, that's right. The king is the head of the church, not the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Church of England is by law established, and the king is the head of the church ever since Henry VIII. So the king is head of the church, but in the church are all sorts of different groups. Like there's some groups who are pretty sympathetic to Roman Catholics, and there are others who are very much against the Roman Catholics. So Charles II was very pro-Catholic, and really toward the end of his life he actually converted to Catholicism secretly. So Shaftesbury was very much in the other camp. He was in the pro-Protestant camp, so naturally he wouldn't get along with the king. So Locke had to go into exile, went to France in the years 1675 to 79, because he was suspected of writing a pamphlet criticizing Charles II for his religious views. It was too pro-Catholic. Now, Locke always denied that he'd written this, but it's hard to say. Locke tended to be a very secretive person, and he wouldn't acknowledge, he often wouldn't acknowledge works he'd done, so he kind of a retiring person. He wasn't somebody who just came out blaring and told you everything he believed. He would be very cautious about things, but he was suspected of writing the pamphlet criticizing him. He had to go into exile. Then there was further trouble, again because of this problem that the Stuarts were very pro-Catholic, and there were a lot of people in England who were opposed to the Catholics. Now, Charles II didn't have a son, so the successor to Charles II was his brother, who would become king as James II. He was brother. So if you didn't like Charles II, he was too pro-Catholic, you really wouldn't like James II because he not only was pro-Catholic, he was a Catholic. So in the what's called the exclusion crisis, Parliament tried to pass a bill that excluding James II from succession to the throne. So what they want to do is say, well, we want to have only a Protestant could come to the throne. So James II was a Catholic, and he wouldn't be eligible to be king. So the king stopped this. It didn't go through. And one thing, if the king could do this, because at the time, the king had an absolute veto power over any act of Parliament. So I don't think they actually passed the bill, but if they passed the bill excluding James, the king could just have vetoed it. The last monarch who vetoed an act of Parliament is Queen Anne, who was later, since that time, the monarch has never vetoed an act of Parliament. So when this whole controversy was going on this exclusion crisis, where people said, well, we don't want James II to be the monarch because he's a Catholic, so we don't want him to succeed Charles II. There were some of the Protestant party who were involved, had a plot. They said, well, when the king and his brother were going out in a coach ride, they planned to seize them and kidnap them. I guess not clear what they would have done after they kidnapped him, but there was a plot to seize the king and his brother, and this was discovered, and people thought that, I think correctly, that Locke was involved in this plot, so he had to go into exile again because people thought he was involved in this plot. So then James II did become king, and after that, the people who didn't like him, thought he didn't like his Catholicism, didn't change their view. And one thing people suspected about James II was that he was very close to the French king, Louis XIV, who was extremely powerful monarch at the time. And people suspected that James II planned to subordinate England to Louis XIV. I put in an extra two, I guess I'm not too good at writing or proofreading my own stuff. Probably too much stuff on Molyneux on the brain. Why not blame him for things? So people thought that James II was trying to surrender English sovereignty to France. So eventually the opponents of James II invited William III, who was the Prince of Orange in the Netherlands, to come over and become King of England along with his wife, Queen Mary. So they said, well, we don't want James II anymore, let's get a new king in. And when they picked William III and Queen Mary, this wasn't an arbitrary choice. It wasn't they were saying, well, let's just pick some Protestant prince and invite him over. Queen Mary was James II's daughter. Now, James II had a son, but the son was a Catholic, so they wouldn't have accepted him. So Queen Mary was actually, if you leave the Catholics out, she was the next in line after James to the throne. And William, in addition to being the son-in-law of James II, he was also in his own right, he was the grandson of Charles I. His mother was, Mary of Modena, who was the daughter of Charles I. So they, William and Mary had actually some claim to the throne. So this is called, this happened in 1688 when William came over. There were a couple of battles between his forces and the force of James II, and James II fled the country and he wound up, he lived in France at the court of Louis XIV. So this is called the Glorious Revolution, I guess, by people who like the 1688 Revolution. Now, it used to be thought that Locke's most famous work on government, which is the two treatises on government. Usually thought these treatises were written to justify the Glorious Revolution. It turns out that isn't right. I think he inserted a few references to King William in the text, but actually these treatises were written earlier, and there was an Oxford scholar in the 20th century named Peter Laslett who established this. Laslett thought they were written around 1679. Now, there are other scholars like Richard Ashcraft who say it was 1682 to 83. But there's general agreement now that it wasn't written at the time, the treatises were not written at the time of the Glorious Revolution. Now, before we go into Locke's political theory, I want to say a little bit about his metaphysical views, what he thought about nature being, because this it plays a role in his political thought also. I remember when we talked about Hobbes rejected Aristotelian philosophy. According to Aristotle, substances, which are kind of freestanding things, things that can exist by themselves in contrast to properties, suppose we say, well, a lion is a substance, the lion's colors, a lion is colored a certain kind of yellowish orange, that wouldn't be a substance, that would be a property of a lion. So aerosol thought, substances have essences, which are or natures, which characterize them. So Hobbes rejected such appeal to natures or essences. He basically said the mind is just classifying things as it wishes in a certain way, for the way we divide up the world is pretty conventional, meaning that people just decide to carve up the world in a certain way, and these names of substances are just names of classes that we give to things that we don't have to do it that way. So really there aren't natures or essences of things. Now Locke didn't agree with that, but he said, well, there are natures or essences of things. The only problem is we don't know what they are. For example, suppose we're asking, we talk about the mind, we're thinking about our, what can engage consciousness, thought. So suppose the question comes up, is the mind an immaterial substance, the way Descartes thought? That Descartes thought the mind can't be composed of matter. The mind is an independent spiritual substance. Or is it just a material entity? Hobbes would say that. So Locke said, well, we really don't know that. We really can't find out what the essence of things are. Things do have natures or essences, but this is beyond human powers to find out. Now, this view creates a problem for Locke's political theory, because, as we'll see, one of the key elements in Hobbes' political theory is that human beings have rights. What you'd expect for someone who is somewhat libertarian, believe people have rights. But how does he know who the human beings are if he can't state what the essence of human beings consist of? We can't know the essences of things, so we can't know who the real human beings are. Now, we could just pick out certain ones, say, well, the human beings are people like you and me or other ones, but wouldn't that just be an arbitrary grouping if we can't know the essences of things? Now, supposing Locke tried to get around that by saying, well, you know, we just identify human beings as the beings that have the power of reason. So rationality is the key property that we use to pick out the human being. But we're not saying that rationality is part of the human being's essence, because we can't know what essence is, but we're just picking rationality. That seems like a good way to classify human beings. And so we're going to say that the rational beings are the ones who have rights. But then there's a problem. If he does that, we could say, why should we care about rationality? Why is that such an important quality? Well, if we could say human beings are in essence rational, then we could say, well, we're picking that out because that's the essential defining or characterizing property of human beings. But we can't do that because we can't know essences according to Locke's doctrine. He thought this was beyond the human capacities. All we get is we see certain things that come, we have information coming into us through the senses, but this doesn't enable us to grasp the inner nature of things. Now, Jeremy Waldron, who's now a professor at professor of political theory at Oxford, had a very good book, I think, on Locke called God, Locke, and Equality. So he says, well, Locke can get around this way problem of how is he, why is rationality important if he can't appeal to essences? Because he could say rationality reflects God's image. So we're, according to Christianity, we're created in God's image, and rationality is the way or the expression of God's image. So see, if this view is, Walden's interpretation is correct, then Locke's Christianity's belief in God is extremely important because it enables him to say why rationality is important. Now the Straussians say, well, Locke really wasn't a Christian at all. He was a secret atheist. They think everybody important is a secret atheist. It always didn't matter who the great philosopher they're talking about. The person is always turned out to be a secret atheist. So on Walden's view, the Straussians are wrong. Locke not only was a believing Christian, but it's very important that God plays a big role in the political theory because it enables us to say why rationality is important. We need to know why rationality is important because that's the way Locke picks out the human beings who have rights and how he can do that, even though in a sense we can't know that and what the essence of things, including human beings, is. Now, in order to understand Locke's political thought, we have to grasp what he means by the law of nature. Now, by law of nature, he didn't mean scientific laws. Like we say sometimes in science, gravitation is a law of nature. It characterizes the way physical bodies behave in the world. They're governed by the law of gravity. But here, what's meant by the law of nature is an ethical law, like what people ought to do. That's given to you by the law of nature. So the system of universal ethical requirements that you have to do, such and such, we have there, let's say the law of nature not to murder. So this is, everybody is bound by that law. We're not supposed to murder. So it's a universal set of ethical rules that we have. And further, Locke says, God has commanded us to follow the law of nature. So given that if God has commanded us to follow it, it's very important. So we have to know, what is the law of nature? So the fundamental law of nature, this is the basic requirement, and other laws are derived from this basic requirement, is that, this is a quotation from Locke, all as may be should be preserved. By may means something that's possible. So we should try to preserve as many human beings as possible. That we have, there are all these people around, so we should try to make sure that as many of them as we can continue to live. And this same view is found later on in Social Statics by the 19th century libertarian philosopher Herbert Spencer. So the fundamental law is that human beings should be preserved in being as much as we can. So, well, if this is right, then suicide wouldn't be allowed, because if you're killing yourself, you're not preserving yourself in being. So Locke would not have accepted the view that some people have, well, suicide is just a matter up to the individual, maybe unfortunate, but it's within our rights to decide when we want to end our own life, if things should come to that. Locke wouldn't agree with that, because the fundamental law of nature is that you're supposed to preserve yourself in being in other beings as much as you can. So Locke said, if you commit suicide, you're quitting your station, your battle station. You have no right to do that. You're required to preserve your own life. Now, from this fundamental law of nature, there are certain derivative laws, laws that follow from this. And the first one, which is one that will be very familiar to libertarians, is each person is a self only. Each person has the right to really to decide what matters relating to his own body. So somebody else can't come along and say, you're required to work for me, or you have to do what I say. Each person is in charge of his own life. And why is each person a self-owner? He didn't use an argument like Hans Hoppe did. If you deny this, you're contradicting yourself. I don't know what he would have said about that, but what he said is each person is a self-owner because you're naturally going to be most interested in your own life, and if you're a self-owner, you will be more likely to preserve yourself than somebody else would. Supposing somebody else owned me, then he might neglect me. He wouldn't have as much of a concern with my life as I do. So if we want people to preserve themselves, we should then have to accept that every person is a self-owner. Now, there's a problem here. Remember, because Locke says that God has really commanded us to obey the law of nature, and God is the ruler of the world, so doesn't have rights over us. So if you say God is really in charge, and one reason you can't commit suicide, Locke says, well, God is really the owner of our lives. So how can you say that really God is the final owner, final authority, and also say that each person is a self-owner? So I think this isn't a real contradiction, because what Locke means is we're self-owners with respect to other human beings. We're subordinate to God and God's will, but no one else can say, well, you have to do what I say. So if we take people as self-owners, but we also say, well, God is the real ruler, our self-ownership is really subordinate to God's command, this wouldn't work in practice if there were some person or group that would say, we're God's representative on earth, so we can tell you what to do, because even though you're self-owners, you're subordinate to God, and we're God's representative. So Locke, to avoid that problem, has to say, and he does say this, that churches are purely private organizations, so people are free to form a church if they want, but churches can't override people's claims to people's rights as self-owners. They can't say, well, look, we are the custodians of God's revelation, so you have to do what we say. All that they could say is, this is our interpretation of the divine law, and whether you want to go along with it is up to you, but we don't have the right to force you to follow this. Now, what about property rights, according to Metten's law of nature? Well, Locke says, and here he quotes a verse from the Bible, that the earth has been given to all human beings in common. So here he's different from the standard libertarian view, is that land, the earth starts off unowned. But Locke says the earth has been given to all human beings in common. But Locke said, well, how are we to take that? How are we to interpret this, that the earth has been given to all human beings in common. Well, one thing, suppose you and I both own something, say we both own a parcel of land, we're the joint owners. So one kind of natural way to say, well, if we're both joint owners, then we both have to agree on how to handle land and what to do about it. Supposing we're joint owners and I say, well, I'd like to grow corn on this land. I couldn't do that just on my own say, so I'd have to get your agreement too, because you're the co-owner. But if everybody owns everything, it would be very cumbersome, because we'd have to get everybody's consent to do anything, and people couldn't survive. And you see, what would be the problem there for the law of nature? Can anybody see what the problem is? If you took common ownership to be everybody has to agree and people couldn't survive, then there's going to be a big problem, because the law of nature said, the fundamental law of nature is that we have to preserve human beings as much as we can. And if we picked an interpretation of property that would it would prevent our survival, that wouldn't work. So what Locke says, in effect, comes around to the standard libertarian view, although with some modification. He says individuals can appropriate land by mixing their labor with things. So you can do something and mix your labor with things, and that way you acquire it. Now, the famous 20th century libertarian philosopher Robert Nozick, as I'm a name dropper, I'll mention I knew him very well for 20 years, talks with him 20 years. He, in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, 1974, mentions an objection. Says, well, if you say you mix your labor with things, so that means you acquire things, why should we say that you get something by mixing your labor with it? Why don't we just say you lose your labor? And he gives a famous example. Suppose I have a glass of tomato juice. I'm just standing by on the beach with my glass of tomato juice. There is the ocean. So I throw the tomato juice in the ocean. So he says, well, wouldn't you just lose your tomato juice? You wouldn't say I've mixed my labor with the ocean by throwing the tomato juice in it. You just say, you lost your tomato juice, you lost your labor. So see, the argument Nozick is giving, the Lockean argument is something like this. You have your own labor, which you own, and you have land out there that's unowned. So you combine the two. You have, I own the labor, land is unowned, so yeah. Owned labor plus unowned land equals owned land. Once I mix my labor, then I own it. So notice that, well, why you have to take it that way? Why can't you say you own your labor, the land isn't owned, so the mixture is you lose your labor. Why should you take it the first way than the second? So I think Locke could reply to this, because he said, well, if you don't allow people to acquire ownership, this will interfere with preserving human beings. This is a fundamental law of nature, that people will be much more productive and they'll survive better if they're able to appropriate individual property. Now, Locke then says you can acquire property by mixing your labor with it. But there is a qualification, which is you have to leave, I should be too lean, I'm really making a lot of mistakes on my writing. I guess I've really got Molyneux on the brain here. Okay, so you have to leave as much as good for others. So I can appropriate land, but I have to leave land as good as I took for others. Now, this leads to a problem. One thing, could I take a break for about a couple minutes. I'll be right back. Just everybody try to think of what I asked you to do during the break. Try to think of what is the problem for the proviso. When I'm back in about a minute or two, please tell me what it is. I'll be right back. We're dealing with this problem that what is the problem with the proviso? And some of you had some good suggestions, but the one who came, and I think you're right that the ones you suggested are all problems, but the one person came closest was the one who said finite amount of land. Now, they say, let's imagine there, everybody's appropriated all the land. There's just one bit of land that hasn't been appropriated yet. So somebody comes along and says, well, can I appropriate that land? And if there's not as much, there isn't as much as good left for others, because by hypothesis, that's the last plot of land. So if the last person can't appropriate land, so what about the second to the last person? Say, well, can he appropriate land? So you might think, well, he could because he's leaving. There'll still be unappropriated land after he takes his land, but he can't do it because he's not leaving as much and as good for others to appropriate. And you see, because the last person can't appropriate, so even if a second to the last person leaves some land, that doesn't help matters because nobody will be able to appropriate the land, because if someone tried to do that, you would be violating the proviso. So then you say, well, the second to the last person can't appropriate, but then that just pushes the problem back further. So you get a backward induction problem. It turns out nobody can appropriate anything. For those of you who know, the famous surprise examination paradox, or the hangman paradox, the argument is a bit like that, or the problems in game theory that are like this. So you see, the argument is, on this way, on the proviso, it would block all interpretation that the last person couldn't appropriate and the second last one couldn't either, and so on. Now, it's more plausible than that to take the proviso as meaning that appropriation can't make people worse off in some sort of more general way. You don't have to leave as much land for others, but your appropriating land can't make them worse off than they would be if that land hadn't been appropriated. And Locke mentioned, well, even if all the land has already been taken, people without land can work for others, and he seems to take that as satisfying his proviso. Now, another limitation on property is that you can't take property and let it spoil. Say you can't just say, well, look at all this fruit out there, so I just like collecting fruit, so I'm gonna just collect all the bananas I can, watch them rot. You couldn't do that because this would go against the fundamental law, because remember, fundamental laws are trying to preserve human beings in existence as much as we can. And if you can just appropriate property, if you appropriate property, other people can't use it, you'll be interfering with human survival, because maybe somebody could have used those bananas that you've left to spoil, could have eaten them, so you're interfering with human survival. However, Locke said, this part, this says you can't take property and let it spoil, that doesn't apply once money exists, because then suppose you appropriate property, but you appropriate land or other objects that you can't use them right away, you can exchange them for other things. So you can appropriate as much as you want, provided you fulfill the proviso and appropriation doesn't make people worse off. Now, there's a very good book that was written by a recent philosopher, David Lloyd Thomas, called Locke on Government. And he has an objection to Locke's labor mixture theory. Remember, Locke says you acquire unowned property, you acquire unowned land by mixing your labor in it and becomes your property, but this is subject to limitations, limited by the proviso, and also until money exists, it's limited by the spoilage requirement. You can't take property that's spoiled. So Lloyd Thomas says, well, look, either labor mixture gives you rights or it doesn't. So how can you say labor mixture gives you the right to property, but you have to add other things as well if mixture is enough? So isn't Locke really contradicting himself? Because he says you acquire things by mixing your labor with them, but on the other hand, he's saying that you have to meet these other conditions as well. So he says, isn't that a contradictory theory? But you see, I don't think that's an interesting argument. I don't think it works because Locke could simply accept the second alternative. He said, the way Lloyd Thomas has phrased it, either labor mixture gives you rights, meaning labor mixture and nothing else gives you rights, or it doesn't. So Locke could say, all right, it doesn't give you rights. But then you say, well, what does? He's free to say what gives you rights is labor mixture plus these other requirements. So it isn't a self-contradictory theory. It's just, I think Lloyd Thomas didn't see, Locke could just accept his second alternative. Now, one thing, so this Locke comes out basically as a strong supporter of property, but one thing might take against that. He says that people have obligations to the old and the infirm, the sick people who can't preserve themselves. Because remember, the law of nature is we should try to preserve human beings as much as we can. But you don't have to take this as really limiting what Locke says about property, because he says this is an obligation of charity, not of justice. So it's not clear that he would accept that if people don't give money to the old and infirm, they could be forced to do so. Now, we have a question that now comes up. In the state of nature, people have property rights. Your property rights aren't dependent on the government. Remember, you acquire property by mixing your labor with land that hasn't been owned, subject to the proviso. So you don't need the government for that. And Locke also held that money can develop without government. So he didn't accept theories, say, that were common in the 19th century, that money comes in the state. He says that money can develop without the government. Now, the way government comes in, he says, in the state of nature, each person can enforce the law of nature, and the law of nature fundamental law of nature is trying to preserve human beings in existence, and then we get derivative laws from that, such as property rights or rights of people against violence. So you can enforce the law of nature. Suppose somebody attacks you, you have the right to defend yourself. Not only that, but you have the right to defend other people who are being attacked. You have the right to enforce law of nature. And in Locke's view, you can punish violations of the law of nature. And what does Locke mean by punishment? Well, suppose somebody steals from you. So according to Locke, you can not only take back what the person has stolen from you, but you can inflict some additional penalty that's going beyond restoration because a person has done something evil, it's violated the law of nature. So Locke says, well, if everybody tries to enforce the law of nature, it's going to lead to chaos because people will differ on the exact application of the law of nature and the appropriate punishment. And say you're involved in a controversy with somebody, say there's a dispute about property rights, say what is the boundary of your land against your neighbor's land, people will tend to make mistakes in their own favor. So if you have a state of nature without any government, this will be pretty chaotic. Now the Straussians say, well, look, even though Locke is talking about pictured state of nature is very differently from Hobbes, because remember Hobbes doesn't say people have rights in state of nature. He talks about a right of nature, that's something else. So people say, well, Locke is very different from Hobbes, but the Straussians say, well, Locke is giving a pretty Hobbesian view of the state of nature, and it turns out to be pretty chaotic. And I think they're exaggerated there, because people do have rights in the Locke state of nature, it's just they trying to enforce them is going to lead to trouble. I don't think this makes it Hobbesian. So what do we do if we have this problem of people having differences of how to enforce the law of nature that leads to trouble? So people can get together and surrender the right to enforce the law of nature to the whole community. So say we're imagine everybody in the class is in the state of nature, so we can, instead of each of us trying to enforce the state of nature, we can just agree, we unanimously agree, that only the whole community can enforce the law of nature. We don't surrender any of our other rights, we just surrender our right to enforce the law of nature. So then, well, we can't have, it wouldn't be practical to have a system where if there's a violation of the law of nature, because everybody in the whole community has to agree on how it's to be dealt with. That would be cumbersome, just like be quite analogous to that problem I was mentioning. You say the earth is owned by everybody in common, to say that means everybody has to agree on how any property is to be used. So what we do is, once all the rights, now wait, I see there's a question there, wait, somebody said, Donaldson, is it not contradictory to create a community organization enforce the law of nature that does so by violating the law? Well, I think it would be, but we're not violating the law because Locke's law of nature, because we have the, we're within the law of nature to surrender our right to enforce the law of nature of the whole community. So he doesn't view that as a violation of the law of nature. So then the whole community can decide by majority rule what the government should be. So we have everybody surrendered to the whole community the right to enforce the law of nature. And the whole community has a majority vote, and they decide what the government should be. Now, they don't have to decide that the government should be one of majority rule or democracy. They could establish whatever form of government they want, except Locke thinks they can't establish an absolute monarchy. So why is it the majority, we know why we don't want the whole community having to decide unanimously, but why the majority? So Locke really used a metaphor. He says, well, a physical body really has to go with the greater force. So if you have a majority, it's just kind of a greater force. That's just a metaphor. What he really seems to be saying is, if you take each person to be equal in rights, then a system of majority rule would show equal respect for persons. If you said, well, some minority should decide this question, you'd have to be saying that this minority, their views count for more than those of other people. And that argument has really been very influential in later political theory of justification for democracy. Now, when Locke says we have to have voting by majority rule, it's not clear. I put it's clear, it's just the opposite of what I wanted. It's not clear whether Locke meant to include women in the original agreement. You could, there are various arguments both ways on that. Now, very important that suppose the majority decides on the form of government, let's say the majority says we're going to have a monarchy. The majority doesn't enter into a contract with the government. So it isn't saying, in Hobbes, everyone is surrendering to the sovereign. It isn't here the majority said, okay, we're going to create a monarchy, entered into some kind of agreement with him. It's just that it was entrusting the government with certain functions, saying, rather than have us continue to decide everything by majority vote for the whole community, we're just giving to you, the government's going to be the agent of the community and decide things. So if the majority thinks the government isn't fulfilling its duties, it can withdraw obedience. And one example is, suppose the government decided to surrender the country to another government, this would be a cause for justified resistance. Remember, this is the lock that would justify the Glorious Revolution, because people were afraid that James II would transfer the government to Louis XIV. Now, here's where the libertarian side of law comes in, is that we have a government because we want to have something to enforce the law of nature. We don't want to have all these disagreements about enforcing the law of nature. But all the government can do is enforce the law of nature. And why is that? Because remember, when people surrender to the whole community their right to enforce the law of nature, that's all they surrendered. They didn't surrender any of their individual rights, such as their right to property. So all they surrendered is the right to enforce the law of nature. So really the government can't do anything beyond enforcing property rights and defense. Now, against this interpretation, Locke sometimes talks about what he calls the prerogative power, which is the power that the executive has, like the king or the president. And what the prerogative power is that Locke thinks sometimes emergency action is required. For example, there'll be an example of emergency action, one that would come up in ordinary life. Supposing there's a fire spreading. In order to prevent the fire from spreading, we have to demolish a house. Or let's say, according to the system, the constitution of the country, only the legislative body can declare war, but they were subject to a sudden attack, so the executive could decide to act right away to counter this. So this prerogative power is there because Locke doesn't have some way of dealing with emergency, but it's very limited. So it doesn't really change, I don't think, the libertarian nature of Locke's views. But there is a Straussian view, which is a Harvey Mansfield, who's a professor at Harvard, said he stresses this prerogative power very much. So according to him, Locke is really giving a system really justifying executive dictatorship. So again, remember, Straussians are trying to say Locke is pretty close to Hobbes. So they think because of prerogative power, what Locke comes up with is pretty close to Hobbesian sovereign, but I don't find this too persuasive. Now, there's a problem for Locke's theory is that your whole system comes about because we have this idea that everybody surrenders to the whole community and community by votes, by majority, where the government is, but people haven't really done that. We haven't had some process where everybody surrendered to the whole community, and then we have the whole community signed by majority vote what the government is. And we'll see later on, especially in the last lecture on Lysander Spooner and Rothbard, that this problem of actual consent is really very important. It's one of the main arguments against the state. So Locke is perfectly aware that this process hasn't really taken place. sometimes he talks about tacit consent to take people just by staying in the country and really agreed to have a government there. But I think he's best taken to be talking, saying not that people have actually made such an agreement, but he thinks it would be rational for them to do so under hypothetical circumstances. But it's a question of whether that actually, a great question of whether that actually justifies a state. Okay, so I think we'll stop there, and then I'm going to open the Q&A box so you can ask questions there or type in the chat. I see somebody has a question. Malcolm, to what extent, when you say lots, you were influenced and coerced by the force of the church, i.e. may have had other view enthusiasm but didn't feel safe challenging the church's state, remember, supposedly anonymously wrote a pamphlet. Well, no, because remember, his views on suicide really follow from his view on the fundamental law of nature, because if you commit suicide, you're going against the fundamental law of nature because you're not preserving yourself in being. So I think that's pretty basic to Locke's views. Now, there are people like the Straussians who think he was concealing his opposition to Christianity. I don't find that too plausible, but if you hold that view, I don't think you would think would be plausible to say he's making it up about what he's condemning suicide. I think you put now put that in. Now, Don says, does Locke have anything to say about people withdrawing their consent individually, but does he maintain majority rights? Well, it's the majority that overrides that because remember, everybody surrendered the right to enforce the law of nature to the community, and the community is governed by the majority. If somebody said, well, I don't like the way the government is functioning, you couldn't just decide to withdraw consent individually because you surrendered your right to enforce the law of nature of the community. And George says, do you have any thoughts on the book Lot by Edward Faison? I think that's a very good book to answer, but he does. He has some criticisms of Locke. He says that Locke really didn't have good arguments against the Aristotelian view. He favors more likes than Aristotelian metaphysics. I think that's a very good book. You know, it's funny you mention that book because I just had an email from Ed Faison, like my attack on Molyneux. So I know him, so it's funny you mention him because I just had an email from him. Now, Sam says, where does Locke's view of punishment originate? I understand the remuneration, but not anything beyond that. The reading didn't explain it clearly. Well, that's actually kind of a common view that Locke is holding, that if you violated the law of nature, you've done something wrong, you deserve to be punished. I think it's a view that you find it goes back to biblical times, you find it among the Greeks and the Romans. The idea wasn't just pure restitution, but that by doing something wrong, you deserve to have something bad happen to you in return, other than having to give back what you stole or pay for compensation. Dante, I understand Molyneux invited you to a public discussion about his theory of UPB. Have you decided on that? Well, yes, you see, there are two things that militate against my accepting such an invitation. One is he's a very practiced and charismatic speaker, and I'm not. I sound like Droopy Dog on Sleeping Pills, so I wouldn't do well in a debate. And then the second thing is, I must say, I really don't think I would really think, I assume for, if you like him for saying this, but I don't think he has much to offer. I don't think he knows much about philosophy at all. I think he's pretty much of an ignoramus. I wouldn't really think I could gain much by such an exchange. I wish I'd never heard of him. He seems to me, not that I ever say anything negative about him, but he seems like a leader of a dangerous cult who is, well, I better stop there. As I say, I never say anything bad about it. Well, let me just open the chat as well. Participant might be trying to revolt, posting, forget what I said about Molyneux. I was just kidding. Everybody knows he's a great man. Okay. Trent says, how could a garage of power trump the law of nature, for example, destroying a house to prevent the spread of fire? Case of defense, invasion by president, is the executive just exercising natural right on not destroying any other right? Well, see, remember, law of nature is that we have to preserve human life as much as we can. So if you could preserve human life by violating somebody's property rights, you can do that. That wouldn't come up very much, but Locke thinks you can do that. George says, on Hobbes, I'm not clear right, I think the initial man in this series of spending potential sovereign won't lose anything, potential sovereign doesn't become a sovereign, the process won't commit him if others don't surrender. That's the argument. He's not going to lose anything, but he's just saying, I'll give up my rights to the sovereign along with other people. So if other people don't, he hasn't lost anything. So he doesn't think that you're going to be losing anything if you surrender to the sovereign and others don't, because your surrender is conditional on other people doing it. So I'm not sure whether you're agreeing or disagreeing. Oh, here, there's more. Sorry, I missed it. Wouldn't he nevertheless be at the mercy of the failed man that tried to become sovereign because the throne would have no arms against him? Well, I see what he's saying. Oh, but look, see, he isn't actually giving up his arms. He's just saying, I'm committing to giving up my arms, provided other people do so. So it isn't that he's saying, okay, sovereign, you can have my sword now, I'm just going to hope other people do so. Then they don't, so then the sovereign is free to go after him. He isn't actually doing it until other people do. Now, Sam said, so it's not necessarily based on logic. Why would he try to create a rational basis but make an assertion without one in this case? Well, what he's doing, it's something like, you know, if you look at Noah's Examination of State Utopia, people have said, well, he has a Lockean view of property. He also has a Lockean approach how the state is created. See, he is trying to get a rational basis, because what he's doing is saying we can imagine a situation, say from the state of nature, in which it would be rational for people to create a government. So that, the fact that we can imagine that kind of, in his sense, explains or justifies actual government, because we can see under these hypothetical circumstances, it would have been rational for us to do that. So that's close enough, in his view, to our actually doing it to count as a good basis for government. So he said, even though we don't actually do it, we could have done it rationally. That, he thinks, is all we need. Well, Okay, we have a few more minutes left if anyone else has something. Here's one. Samuel says, how would you compare Ayn Rand's estate to Locke's? There are some similarities in that she has a minimal state also. I think hers is different in that it's just more that people actually make contracts with the state to, if they want protection or have the state enforce contracts, they just pay fees to the state. But the difference from Rothbard and anarcho-capitalism, there aren't competing agencies. You can do that. So I think it's similar functions, but in Locke's system, you don't have individuals just contracting with the state for particular services. Okay, well, we still have a few minutes. Someone says, I'm not quite finished yet. I remember one time when I was a student at UCLA, my greatest teacher, Walter Starkey, was once giving a lecture, and he suffered from asthma, and he started coughing in the lecture. He had an asthma attack. Everybody thought he'd finished the lecture, but he hadn't, and he couldn't tell people he was still going on because he was too busy coughing. George says, on Hobbes, I think libertarians say first creation of sovereign would require orderly agreement. That orderly agreement came without a sovereign, hence order is possible. Well, I think Hobbes would say people could have enough order to make the agreement, but not enough to carry out society without a sovereign on a permanent basis. The second question, George says, what makes Hobbes believe the sovereign would provide order? The sovereign is weak in comparison to the larger public. Well, remember, people surrendered their arms to the sovereign, and once they'd done that, it would be in their interest to obey the sovereign because they want order, so they converged on obeying him because it would be in their interest to do so, and individuals would lack the power to resist the sovereign, so they surrendered to the sovereign. Now, everybody decided to go against the sovereign, you couldn't preserve order, then you wouldn't be the sovereign anymore. You know, the great philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe, when she was an undergraduate, said she'd been reading Leviathan. She said, well, Hobbes' argument seems to be you shouldn't rebel against the sovereign unless you can. So it's kind of insane. If if the sovereign is preserving order, then you can't rebel against him. But if he can't preserve order, he's not the sovereign anymore. And George says, order didn't exist in is a prior underlying condition. The sovereign couldn't solve a problem in ultimate sense. Well, you may be right about that, but Hobbes didn't think so. Hobbes would say the sovereign can't create all the conditions of order, but by surrendering to the sovereign, you can eliminate certain sources of disorder, such as conflicts among particular ideologies that would be present if he were there. Now here's one, Dan says, was Locke influenced by any private property philosophies? Well, Richard Ashcraft has done some work on that. He was actually quite influenced by the Lovelies, and he read them, so I think they were the main ones who had the private property philosophers who had some influence on him. And there's a friend of mine, I think I mentioned, Roberta McDougall, who's doing some research on the Lovelies and their influence on him. I think that's currently under more investigation than probably in the past. Well, I guess we're about out of time now. So thanks, everybody. Hope to see you. Remember, next week we're having the lecture, then there's a break the week afterwards. Okay, so thanks, everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Bye, everybody.